Can fight. In the UK, the latest stats show that 42% of marriages end in divorce, even though the rates are now falling. It suggests that we are familiar with dysfunctional family life. Now, perhaps you're sitting here this morning and you've known firsthand the struggles with sibling rivalry or parents at war. Our story this morning is a classic case of two brothers who literally fight from the moment they're born. Jacob and Esau are the sons of Isaac and the grandsons of Abraham. And if you've been here over the past few weeks, you know that we've been covering some of the key stories from Genesis, and we've looked at Isaac, we've looked at Abraham. And now we have this story of Jacob and Esau. Now, they're born after their mother, Rebekah, had struggled to conceive. And Isaac prays that God might open her womb. As she falls pregnant, God tells Rebekah that she will have twins and that the younger one will rule over the elder one. You might remember the story of when they're young men, and Esau, the elder brother, he's a hunter and he's favoured by his dad. His dad, and we read it in this passage, likes the taste of wild game. So the fact that his son's a hunter means he can bring it back and give him the food that he likes. So he's the favourite son. Whereas Jacob is described as quiet. He tends to stay at home a bit more. And he's favoured by his mother. One day Esau returns from hunting and he finds Jacob's been cooking. And he begs his brother for some food. He says, "I'm starving. I'm ready to die. I'm so hungry. Can I have some of your food?" And Jacob says, "Well, you can have my food if you give me your birthright instead." Now, his birthright was basically when their father Isaac died, the eldest son would get the lion's share of the inheritance. And Isaac was a rich man with lots of stuff. So it was a big inheritance to be had. And so what Jacob is saying is, "You can have this bowl of food that I've made if I have your inheritance." Esau is a bit dim. And he says, "Yeah, all right." He then resents Jacob for being tricked. So we have this serious case of a strained family relationships going on here, where prayer once united Isaac and Rebekah in their marriage, their favouritism now divides them. Brothers argue, as brothers do, but in this case it develops a serious, almost deadly rivalry. And in our passage from chapter 27, we see how this rivalry intensifies and descends into deceit and lies and anger. It's an extraordinary scene that unfolds, and no one comes out of it smelling of roses. And yet somehow, God's promise to bless the nations through Abraham's line is maintained. And his decision to allow Jacob to be the one who receives this blessing is upheld. Now, there's so much that we could say about this passage this morning. There's so many different angles to approach it from. The role of blessing and why it was so important. Why it was irrevocable. The developing pattern in Genesis of poor leadership shown by the men who were supposedly the head of their family. But the overriding question that I'm left with as I was reading this passage is simply why? Why Jacob? Why does God continue to bless Jacob even after this outrageous act of deception? Jacob is a scoundrel. He's manipulative. He's scheming. He's deceitful. He's a liar. It's nothing short of scandalous that he receives both his father Isaac's blessing and God's blessing. Why? Why, after all that he's done, does he still receive these blessings. It's a bit like that age-old question of why do good things seem to happen to bad people? So for just a few minutes this morning, I'd like us to think about the answer to this question. Why Jacob? It's a very basic answer, and we could stop the sermon really at the end of this sentence if you want. I'm not going to, but there's a very basic answer, which is simply, it's God's grace. God's grace is the answer to why Jacob. When we first read this story about Jacob, we can be left feeling frustrated, confused, maybe wondering, how has he gotten away with that? It just doesn't seem fair. So as we search for an answer, or perhaps simply an explanation for this, God's grace must be our starting point. Now, if you aren't totally sure what God's grace means, grace is basically getting what we don't deserve. Grace is when we get something that we don't deserve. For example, grace is the mother whose teenage son has been murdered on the streets and who stands in front of the TV cameras and says, "I forgive the person who did this." Now, that murderer doesn't deserve forgiveness, but he's been forgiven nevertheless. Sometimes we confuse grace and mercy. They're often used together. But mercy is different. Mercy is about not getting what we do deserve. So if grace is about getting what we don't deserve, mercy is about not getting what we do deserve. God's grace is where we start when we want to know why Jacob. There's a favourite Old Testament scholar of mine. I show as much of a nerd I can be that I've got a favourite Old Testament scholar. Walter Brueggemann is an American. He's still alive. He's pretty old, but he's still going. And he says that it's a scandal that Jacob receives a blessing from Isaac. But equally scandalous is the generosity of God's grace. He says the powerful grace of God is a scandal. Think about that word, scandal. A scandal is something that causes outrage. Something that may be seen to be morally or legally wrong. We associate scandals with, you know, the front page of the tabloids. Celebrities caught doing things they shouldn't have been doing. The powerful grace of God is a scandal because it doesn't make sense to us. It's outrageous in every sense of the word. That Jacob receives Isaac's blessing and God's blessing is outrageous. He doesn't deserve it. And the reason that God's grace is so outrageous to us is because it upsets the way that we think things should be done. It upsets us because it's not the way that we would do things. God's grace doesn't make sense to us because it's disruptive. It goes against the desires that we have within us that want order and predictability. As humans, we tend to say, well, that person over there, that person over there is like that. They've done this thing and that's the kind of person they are. Therefore, we treat them like this. And that person's different because they're like this, so we treat them differently, like we treat them this way. And that's how human beings tend to operate. But God doesn't. God takes these notions, chucks them up in the air, and causes chaos. The story of Jacob is a visible example, expression of God's scandalous grace from the very moment that Jacob is born. All the things that we'd expect of that culture at that time, that the firstborn would inherit the father's blessing and the lion's share of the inheritance. The blessing that God had promised through Abraham's line would fall through Isaac and then through his eldest son is flipped up in the air. Even the basic thing that the obedient would prosper and the wicked would suffer or be punished, none of this happens. I don't know about you, but I find that really annoying. Why doesn't God stick to a formula? Good things for good people, bad things for bad people. Now, even when we think about that a bit and we recognise that none of us are truly good, we're all flawed individuals. We all have bad bits to each of us, even if we try to hide them or keep them away. So only God is truly good. Even when we recognise that, why isn't it as simple as those who at least try to be obedient to God have at least better stuff happen to them than those who don't? Surely that makes a more reasonable argument, a more reasonable logic. So when we read the story of Jacob, it's infuriating because that doesn't happen. I don't like Jacob. And yet there he is. He's blessed, even though he's a devious little so-and-so. The story of Jacob is infuriating until we begin to grasp what God's grace is really about. God's grace is scandalous because God's love for us is equally scandalous. God's love knows no limits, it knows no boundaries, it can't be stopped or blocked or diverted. Now, if you think it's going to be hard to escape the coronavirus, let me tell you about God's love. In Psalm 139, it says we can't escape God. If we go up to the heights and the skies and ride on wings like eagles, we can't escape God. If we go down to the very depths of the sea, we can't escape God. There you are. God's grace and God's love are tied together. Because of the depth of God's love for you, God extends his grace. And he does that in the hope that we might choose to join him in the plans that he has for us. That we might revel, enjoy the promises that God has for you and for your life. Promises for a future and a hope. And God's promises and God's plans are far greater than the ones you have for yourself. If we look back at the story, Rebecca and Jacob conspire to get Isaac's blessing deceitfully. But Rebecca knew that God's blessing had already been assigned to Jacob. When we stop and think about it, and if we've read the previous chapters so we're more familiar with where this has come from, God has told Rebecca that Jacob is going to receive his blessing and not Esau. They didn't need to do this. It was greedy. It was unnecessary. It was human beings acting and trying to force God's plan to happen in their time. And the consequences are so far reaching. If we read on from this over the next couple of chapters, we find that Isaac and Esau are left devastated. Jacob has to flee and he never sees his mother again. All because they try to manipulate the things of God. And yet, where Jacob is destructive, where Jacob destructs, God constructs. God is desperate for Jacob to seek him earnestly, to walk with God like his father and his grandfather have done before him. And so God's grace, which seems so scandalous to us, is extended to Jacob. And in time, we find that he wrestles with God, quite literally, in one scene. And finally, he submits to God's leading. And it's only then that peace can be made with his brother. Only then can the blessing of God be fulfilled through him. God subverts the conventions that we hold to time and time again. Because God is so creative. God refuses to be boxed up. God doesn't want to be made into a simple formula. Because God isn't the answer to a riddle or a maths problem. God is love. We're told it time and again through the scriptures. And that love is so scandalously deep that it requires an equally scandalous amount of grace. So we can choose to remain angry and frustrated with Jacob. Perhaps we see similarities in our own lives of people we know. So we can stay angry or frustrated at them, or maybe even, dare we say, envious. Or we can realise that this grace extends to us as well. Now, the peak example of God's grace in action also happens to be the meeting point of God's mercy as well. Takes place on the cross of Calvary where Jesus dies. In that moment, Jesus spares us the judgment that ends in death. It's a judgment that our disobedient and flawed lives deserve. We deserve to be judged and deemed unacceptable in God's eyes. But instead, through Jesus, we're given hope and life, even though we don't deserve it. It's where grace and mercy meet. It's the scandal to end all scandals. That you and I should be spared instead of Jesus. And yet here we are. Here we stand and sit together. And God's invitation remains open. It remains open for you to know him. And to be let in on the big secret that God has plans for your life. And has plans of a hope-filled future for you. Plans that last beyond our weak and frail bodies. That scandalous grace. That we might be looking down upon and questioning when we see it in action with Jacob, is the same grace that is offered to us. It's the same grace that provides us with a future. May we take up God's offer of that grace and embrace it. Walk in the light of it. And may God reveal his plans for your future to you. You might walk faithfully in his footsteps. Amen.